All right, this is side two of the November 24th interview. So you remember?
Oh, the thrown off stride point that the author is making there is really a matter of revenue shortages, which happen periodically, that were related to using less gasoline. And that was the time of the 73, 74, at 75, that area, the energy crisis we saw. But I don't think that was a major off stride. It just related to a couple of things. One, with fewer resources, how do you select your projects? What do you have to cut back? And another, it was consistent with, probably not the cause of, but consistent with more interest in mass transit.
I've also read some that there was a question at that time in the transportation department of noise abatement, and there were some issues about that. And I just wondered if during the McCall period, if there was a special interest in environmental type of issues in relation to the transportation.
There may have been some of that. I'm trying to relate to periods. What really was happening nationally and certainly in our state was more concern about environmental questions. Environmentalist wasn't a word until somewhere in the late 60s, I think. And the Department of Environmental Quality was set up, I believe, in 1969. That was another one of those things that was happening in terms of changes of government, because there were enough environmental concerns that it was determined we needed a Department of State Government to deal with them. So there was that kind of concern. I think it was consistent with what McCall's views were, and thinking about that time, we were talking about the Willamette Greenway, we were talking about public beaches. Some of those issues had an environmental component to them. The noise abatement question, I really think, came more from the federal end. Some of the requirements built into the highway bills required noise abatement for highway projects, which hadn't previously happened. And there was, at the same time, a bill related to cleaning up of wrecking yards or junkyards and fencing those. So it was consistent overall with environmental questions, beautification, and so on.
Oregon has a law about billboards, right?
I think it's a national law, but that came about the same time, because I recall that some people were not real pleased that we're trying to spend money on highway projects, that they had to spend as much on billboard removal and fencing junkyards and so on.
Now, there we've alluded briefly to an important figure at this time, the man that was the head of the Highway Commission, Glenn Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have occasion to work with him?
Quite a bit. More than I deserved in one sense, because had I been working my way up in the transportation department or highway department, I wouldn't have seen him much because he was at the top and he would generally deal with a state highway engineer or a director of the transportation department. But because I came in as a consultant and then I was a special assistant to the director, I had lots more to do with him.
And how would you describe him?
He was unique. If you asked around, most people would say in political circles that he was the most powerful person in Oregon. And it always intrigued me that the most powerful person in Oregon never made a point of that. He didn't smash his fist on the table, and he didn't... As a question of style, uses speakerphone a lot, and it didn't matter if he was speaking to Senator Hatfield or the governor. If you were sitting in his office, he'd be on his speakerphone, and you'd watch him operate. And he was persuasive, and he'd do things by saying, some of the people feel, don't you think, and wouldn't it be nice if, and people, if he thought it was nice, usually would think it was nice too. So he got lots of things done. By being persuasive rather than aggressive and demanding.
Well, where did his power come from?
Well, he was head of Pacific Corps, which was a good large company at that time and very, very involved. and how he worked his various connections in that basin Pacific Corps, and then also being chair of the Highway Commission for so long was an important position. So it was interesting to me. I didn't see him develop the power base, perhaps, but I saw him use it. And it was seldom that someone would run for major office without checking in with him. And if there were important people getting together for lunch to talk about the direction of the state or who should run for what or political contributions, he would either have called the meeting or be an important member.
What do you think were his limitations?
I'm not sure. That's an interesting question, because I think about his strengths as really being positive and always. If there was a meeting where staff people would come in with a problem, he'd always think about solutions, and he'd walk out of the meeting thinking you had to solve it and fix it. He had a sense of humor. He moved things in the right direction. I saw him as really having outstanding leadership qualities. I didn't ever see him step up and intellectually solve the problem himself, and I'm not sure that's a limitation. Frankly, I think it converted to a strength. He'd get other people involved in the solution and steer it and guide it, and he wouldn't let people have major arguments that were going to hurt the city or the state overall. He'd make sure they got together and got some solution. So if someone really thinks that a leader needs to solve the problem himself or have all the best ideas, you might say that's a limitation. I ended up thinking it was a strength.
So the word that's coming to my mind is being a facilitator. Was that?
Well, that's a good word. I don't know if he would have liked that word. Okay. It sounds a little bit too touchy. He did facilitate lots of things and bring people together. It would have been interesting to see him really get mad and aggressive about something. I never did, but I don't know that he would have ever let on.
Now, I read a quote from Mr. Thomas Vaughan, who was the head mm-hmm. of the Oregon Historical Society at the time, and he said that because Jackson had so much power, and power from his personality mm-hmm. and whatever, he stunted the growth of others.
I don't believe that. Tom's a good observer, but I think that Jackson was very responsible for the growth of others. Now, maybe Tom has some different others in mind, but my examples would be when the Transportation Commission was established, among the three early appointees were Tom Walsh, Mike Hollern, and Peter Bricks, and they were all late 30s to 40, and I think they did some tremendous growing. We still, when I get together with them, we still talk about Glenn and his days and how he did things and how we can do them the same way now to make sure we get some accomplishments. Mm-hmm. Now, it could be that in terms of major power brokers, they didn't do as well as because Jackson was there. But in terms of developing younger talent and doing something for the state, he was great.
But I wondered if he was talking in terms of sort of overshadowing so many other people.
It may be, because, Tom's a good observer and may have that in mind. But if I talk about Jackson's characteristics, I think about how he developed talent as opposed to stunning it.
Another thing that he said was that Vaughan said, was that Jackson had the power to get things done, to make people do what they don't want to do. Is that something you would agree with?
That's a good statement.
And I'm wondering how he did that, or examples of that.
He'd get on his speakerphone and make a phone call, or get two or three people together in a room. And he may have done this, but I never saw him say, "Damn it, you have to see it this way and come around to this conclusion." As you think about some people do with doing with power, I always saw him with a, "Don't you think we'd all be better off if this didn't happen?" And within the last couple of months, Tom Walsh has talked to me saying, "Here are two major." One of two major entities in the Portland area who are having a battle, and one of them will win, maybe both of them will lose publicly, but is that the sort of thing Glenn would have let happen? I mean, still 20 years later, we're still saying, Tom's view, Walsh that is, I said Glenn would have called both parties and said, this isn't good for everybody. Somebody's got to get together and get a solution.
So is there a modern day Glenn Jackson?
That's what we grope with sometimes, and it's been missing for a while. Tom and I actually had lunch and talked about that. Is there a modern day Glenn Jackson, or could there be one? And have the times changed so much? I think we're closer. Actually, Tom's view, historians will like to see how it comes out, but Tom's view is Dick Wrighton, who's my boss right now, who just walked by, may be the closest to a Glenn Jackson. And he comes from knowing lots of people, being president of Portland General Electric, very involved in things, very constructive. There's some very similar qualities.
He also worked in government for a period of time.
Right.
For Goldschmidt.
That's right.
I know. I have to tell you, though, I read that Jackson, when I was reading some of the projects that he was involved with when he was the chair of the Highway Commission, one of them was the decision to put I-5 on the East Bank. That was his decision. Do you remember that?
No, that really preceded me.
Okay. So I was wondering if what other options he had considered, but that wouldn't be something that you would
agree. I don't know.
Right. I wondered, in retrospect now, some people might think that was a decision that might not have been one of his best ones.
I'm not sure. It's not clear yet whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, and there are some other options that people are obviously discussing today. But it's not quite fair if the decision was made 30 years ago with lots of different variables. You can also talk about I-5 being down the middle of the valley and saying, if we built that today, would we build it along the foothills or moved it considerably? Maybe, but the times were so different. He probably would have been described in much less favorable terms had he said, let's build it along the coast foothills and make it 8 or 10 or 12 miles longer. Probably someone at that time would have said, that's outrageous.
So as you look at Jackson altogether, is he a person that you liked?
Oh, definitely. And I don't know that I knew him well. I mean, I dealt with him, as I say, more than I might have given my position and because of historical circumstances. But he's not someone that you really know how he ticks inside, or at least I didn't. I don't think a lot of people did. Because men tend not to talk about personal things anyway, or what they're really thinking or feeling. And we never really shared that kind of conversation. And he had a different sort of lifestyle. I mean, his wife, he spent his time in Medford, and he'd always talk about doing fence work out in the farm that he'd bought, and his wife lived a lot of time in the Hilton, and what seemed to some people sort of a lonely existence. Glenn's grandson works in this building now for the Economic Development Department. I was speaking with him within this last week just about Glenn and characteristics, and he had to give up some family things to do all the things he did. But I don't really know. I mean, I liked him. I didn't really know his personal side.
His nickname was the General.
Yeah.
Do you know why that?
No, the generals get things done. I don't know that Tom McCall didn't do that. I can think of him, remember him talking about, well, we better talk to the General.
Jerry Frank said about him that he never looked back or brooded about something that couldn't get done. He was very forward-looking.
He was, but I can't remember him ever thinking something couldn't get done. As a staff person, I never left his office without saying, how do I fix this, or how do I get a solution, how do we work together to do that, because he didn't let you think this is impossible.
And I also read that what he considered his crowning achievement was the I-5 bridge across the Columbia.
Did he really?
Named after him.
Did he really?
That's what this article that.
That surprises me, but that's fine.
I couldn't. I was going to ask you why.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a particularly difficult bridge to?
Oh, it had to be. It's a huge undertaking, and there are some political sides to it. It's just getting that whole project done was a major undertaking. But it really happened. It got done after he left the department. So his good feeling about that had to be all the work that went into getting it cited and placed and agreed upon.
All right. Then I think we'll get ready to begin moving into your time working for Straub with mm-hmm. the Department of Energy. Have we basically covered the major issues of the transportation time, or is there something you would like to add?
I think we're missing something if I think through those years. Let me ramble a little bit. When George Baldwin, the transportation bill was passed in the 1973 legislative session, again with Earl Blumenauer being prominent, getting it through the legislature. It was then George Baldwin's task as the director and then the new Transportation Commission to set up a department and make it work. And in doing that, he brought in some people who were more administratively inclined and worried about what kind of structure does a transportation organization need to function. And it tended to be a lot more focused on administration and personnel and managing finances than what the Highway Division had, or Highway Department had been used to. They were more of an engineering operation that built and then maintained highways. And the real story of that period was the sort of battle between the long-standing highway personnel and ways of doing things and George's new way of trying to get the department managed. And that took a long, long time. When I was director years later, there are still some remnants of that. But George was trying hard to get that done, and it was hard work. So my job as a special assistant related to policy had related a little bit to the struggle. I would do some things related to policy. An example might be, should a transportation fund be created as opposed to just a highway fund, so you can use it on any transportation investments? Well, I could develop a paper that would make that argument, and people might sit around and nod, but no one within highways would take it real seriously because they had a dedicated highway fund. So it was real hard to get ideas through the Highway Division, and George, as a director, had to wrestle with that, how to make the different modes of transportation have a more equal spot at the table. So that, through George's years, that's what the struggle was. The thing that's missing is that, before I got to energy, was that Governor Straub brought in Bob Burko as a director, and that's probably worth a few minutes.
All right, well, please.
Bob Burko was a talented younger person. He was mid-late 30s, brought in to be transportation director by Straub, even though the law said that the Transportation Commission appoints the director. And there was a real battle that, at least from the inside, was huge. I don't think most of the public knew it, with basically Straub saying, I want this new person to run the department, and Glenn Jackson saying, that's not my preference. And that played out behind the scenes, and ultimately, Jackson blinked. He didn't have to, but he, I think, ended up thinking in terms of serving Oregon and getting things done, you should let the governor have who the governor wants in that job. And this was in 1976, I'm thinking, when Burka was there, there were some very tough times with the department because the department tended to reject Burka as an organ transplant that didn't quite fit the body. And I think it was known that the chairman didn't really like him, or the Transportation Commission wasn't real happy with that either. So here was Burko in a very tough situation where he had trouble dealing downward in the department and upward with the commission. And if someone were writing the history of that portion, it's a longer history than we're getting into. It was a little awkward for me because I had worked with Baldwin and Fred Clabo and with Jackson and knew this was going on, yet I was working for Burko. And I had some problems with Burko's style, as did others. So just about the time that Burko was reorganizing the department, or at least reassigning people to do some things that he wanted, he offered me a policy job that was sort of assistant director for policy and planning or something like this. And close to that time, The governor's office called me up, Governor Straub, and asked if I'd be interested in the energy department. So the transition, this is a little background for it. I told Burko I wasn't sure. I had some other options, and I know he was disappointed with that, and thought maybe I was a little less than loyal for thinking of not taking the job. But when I was offered the director of the Department of Energy, that was clearly an alternative that was better than the one I had. To direct a department was perceived by everyone as better than being assistant director for Burko. So I moved into that one about that time, but it was out of sort of a stormy situation at transportation.
Well, you said that you had troubles with his style. What was his style?
I'm not sure how to characterize it now, but he was very smart and tended to think he had the idea. In fact, it really conflicted with Jackson's. I think Bob would tend to have an idea and think that when he'd tell everybody to go do it, that they would understand it and believe it and go do it. And he'd find that he'd, after directing people to do something, find it didn't get done because people thought it was a bad idea and never had any equity in his idea. And he tended to tend to be more of a planner, policy person, and you need a certain amount of that, but a lot of the people who were doers in the highway division didn't want to spend so much time planning or talking about policy. They wanted to build highways. And he wasn't able to handle that conflict very well. So had he been more of a Glenn Jackson in style, and probably recognized it takes a little longer to get things done, that would have helped. And I think he had some interpersonal problems with some of the people. So he didn't engender loyalty, and he and I had some conflicts on that. One in particular, I remember at a big retreat, he was saying some negative things about Jackson. This was like 20 of us sitting around a table, and I took him on that. Said it was just inappropriate for him to be talking about the chairman in those terms, and it didn't help the department. And so that was, I think I'd describe that as a conflict.
How long did he last?
I forget right now for sure, but I think it was like 3 years. Wait a minute, he had some work in 5 different years, but it was a little bit of one and then 3 solid years and then one day in the next year. But that's how long he lasted. It was really during the Straub period.
And then when Straub left, it was about that time that he left too?
About that time. Atiyah would clearly have made that. If Atiyah did not fire him, he would have. I think he left before Atiyah had the chance.
Later on, I know, you've mentioned Fred Clabo, mm-hmm. and I know that ultimately he does head up the Department of Transportation, doesn't
mm-hmm.
he?
Right.
And that's who you succeed.
Right.
But at this, I'll get into that okay. more Fred Clabo somewhat later, but was he still back at, he had been head of the highway division. Was he still there at that point in time when Burko was there?
Yes, he was. And it was very hard for him because he headed the highway division and loyalty was important to Fred. He had some real problems with how Burko was operating, but he was the kind of person who would really internalize him rather than talk about him. And I know those years were tough on him.
Maybe took their toll later on.
I think they did.
All right. So you left a touchy situation in the transportation department, but truthfully, you went into another touchy type situation in the energy department, because when you came into the energy department, it was because your predecessor had been fired.
Right.
Would you describe that situation?
Energy department was created in 1975, again by pulling some 2 or 3 areas together and creating some new functions. And it was a general feeling that the state wasn't doing well enough on energy demand forecasting, for example, or really that utilities weren't, and the government needed to do more. And that their energy conservation was important. There were enough issues there that it made sense for government to create an energy department at the time. So Lon Topaz was selected as the first director, and he brought, as the statute required, brought various people together and then made some new appointments. and was moving ahead pretty aggressively on creating a role for the Energy Department. I think he was perceived on the outside as sort of a young upstart and didn't necessarily know how government was supposed to work. He came from the Public Utility Commission and I think was relatively successful there. But in any case, in the Energy Department, he was tending to make waves. I didn't pay too much attention to that. I dealt with Lon on transportation policy questions. And again, from the transportation point of view, we were more of a giant, and this was a small upstart agency. And he could talk about the importance of mass transit and saving energy, but it didn't necessarily have much importance to the rest of us. So I didn't pay too much attention to energy outside of doing the paper I mentioned and then having that involvement. And then I got a phone call from Janet McLennan, who is the governor's natural resource person, asking if I'd come and talk to her about the energy job. And this, I believe, was right after Lon was fired, pretty publicly fired, and that was uncommon for Oregon government. So I talked to her, not quite knowing why she was seeking me out. And it happens because I think the big thing that Lon got in trouble with was the demand forecast for electricity, and the utilities really were negative on that. And this was just a draft document that was out, but it showed negative growth for electricity when utilities were forecasting 6% per year. Huge difference. And it had lots to do with their siting plants and the future of, they saw the future of their companies, and why was this new department and new director in particular getting in their way. I think what happened, because I had no idea, I'd never dealt with Governor Straub, and why was he asking me, I have to believe that when Straub was saying, what are we going to do about this, Jackson said, well, we got this young economist over here who might give you some help. He'd say it about that way. So I had an interview with Janet McLennan and said, yeah, I'd like to do that. And we went in to see Governor Straub and had about a 20-minute meeting and said, okay, you're it.
Well, you're right about the very public firing. It made the headline of the Oregonian, and they put it in terms of the Straub axes energy chief.
Selects economist for right, job.
Huh? Right. Well, I even have your picture here from.
Is that the same guy?
Yeah. Oh, there he is. Jeez. Right.
That's been a while.
You're on the right there with Lon.
Yeah, I see Topaz is liberally quoted here. So that was about October 1. They said I'd be able to step in. Okay, most of this is just Topaz's view.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It says here that when the governor talked about wanting a new person, that he said, he's quoted as saying, I want to have a person directing the department who is a research specialist and an economist. Hmm. So maybe he fit his requirement. Do you think?
I suspect.
It sounds like it fits you perfectly.
I suspect he, but I don't know that he didn't get an idea that maybe I could do that job and say, here's some things he could say he wanted. I know how those things are done in terms of press releases on people. And I didn't know Straub that well, but.
Well, there was some question whether there had been behind-the-scene pressure put on him by the utilities to get rid of Topaz.
I think their public statements were no. I think it was obvious there were. I mean, whether that was direct pressure or someone was in his office twisting his arm or whether they just said, this doesn't work. I mean, everybody knew that there was a real conflict, and that represents pressure to a governor.
Who was more accurate about the forecast?
That's a real interesting question because I inherited a really good staff at Energy. And a lot of those same people, four or five of them, are very involved in energy even today in different places and all well respected. And we went in and what I was supposed to do is take a good look at the forecast. And frankly, the forecast ended up about the same as what Topaz had. I had a lot more credibility as it happened, and in looking at it, and I worried a lot more about style and how it was released and who was brought in. Lon believed a little bit more in shock value, and he was disadvantaged because that was a draft report, and people, I think, maybe overreacted to the draft that showed negative. Actually, my forecast, and my is too personal, it was a staff forecast, ended up showing a much lower rate of growth than the utilities believed. And I think they were surprised because I seemed to be a person who could listen to them and deal with them. But nevertheless, the facts were other than what they believed.
So did they, when you said it, did they believe you more?
They weren't wildly enthusiastic about it, but I think they were starting to suspect that maybe they had been wrong. And the stakes were huge here because Portland General Electric, for example, was at the forefront of siting the Pebble Springs nuclear plant. And they were doing it partially because they thought that the demand